It is National Surrogacy Week. My name is Alex Pye, and my guest on this podcast is Sarah Jones, who is the head of surrogacy at Surrogacy UK and a five-time surrogate herself. Hi, Sarah.
Hello, morning.
So would you just take a second just to introduce yourself, please, and maybe tell us a little bit about what inspired you to become a surrogate in the first place?
So my name's Sarah Jones. I've been involved in the surrogacy community for the last 20 years. I initially wanted to be an egg donor, but at the time you could only be an anonymous egg donor, and that didn't really sit well with me. I wanted to sort of know what happened to my eggs. And while I was Googling egg donation, surrogacy sort of popped up. And the more I read about surrogacy and the fact that you make a connection with the parents and that you have a lifelong relationship with the parents, that sort of spoke to me. And to me, it didn't seem such a big leap from egg donation to surrogacy. So I joined an organisation called Surrogacy UK just when they had started, just when they'd formed. And a couple of years later, I gave birth to my first surrogate baby, who has just turned 18. And it was such a brilliant experience, really positive, that I decided to do it again four more times over the course of the next 18 years. So I now have five surrogate babies who are 18, 17, 8, 4, and little Arthur has just turned 9 months, and I have three of my own children. But I decided that I wanted to give something back to the surrogacy community, and so I volunteered to be a support worker with Surrogacy UK, and then eventually that turned to me sitting on the board of trustees at Surrogacy UK, and so now surrogacy is pretty much everything I do now.
Brilliant. Not that surrogacy is addictive in any way.
Not in any way. No, you don't get addicted at all.
I've spoken to several surrogates within the organisation. They've all said exactly the same thing. So in those 20 years, no doubt you've heard and been asked lots of questions in varying degrees of background knowledge. And the point of today's podcast is it's a myth-busting podcast. In my role as a social media and PR officer for Surrogacy UK, part of my responsibility has now come to consulting on scripts for TV dramas, dramatizations that revolve around surrogacy storylines. And because of that, because dramatizations don't often depict the truest sense of the subject, we do have a lot of misconceptions, and I think our biggest concern within SUK is that what people see on TV, they will take as gospel, and they will think that that is how every surrogacy journey operates based on what they've watched on television. So, as I say, this podcast is very much a myth buster to try and dispel some of those misconceptions. So what I will do, Sarah, if that's okay with you, is I'll kind of play the part of the naive question asker that you've no doubt encountered over your 20 years yes. in the surrogacy community. And I will let you take the role of Mythbuster, and you can just address the questions and just contradict what I'm asking, really, I guess, is what I'm
okay.
trying to say.
Absolutely, no problem.
So when you're ready, here we go. Okay. So the first question, does straight surrogacy involve the intended father having sex with the surrogate?
No. of course not. The requirements of a parental order is that a baby has been conceived through artificial methods. A baby has to be conceived through artificial methods. So that's either through IVF, through a clinic, or through at-home artificial insemination. So using a little oral syringe and a pot. Also, intended fathers don't want to sleep with a surrogate. They've usually got a partner themselves, either a male or a female partner, and are not in any way attracted to the surrogate. No, surrogate usually has a partner, husband, and she doesn't want to sleep with the intended father either. So no.
A syringe in a pot, it segues us nicely into question two. So the second question is, do at-home inseminations really involve a turkey baster?
I'm not entirely sure how much sperm men think they produce, but a turkey baster is not at all required. You need a teeny tiny little oral syringe where you get maybe 1 or 2 mils. there's not actually a lot of sperm that's produced when it's all collected in a pot. So those people thinking they need a turkey baster perhaps think a little bit too much of themselves.
Be genuinely interested to know where that question had come from and what the person had seen and where they had seen it. Okay, next question. Do you know who the parents are who you did it for?
Yeah, this is a question I get asked a lot, especially when I'm pregnant. Oh, do you know who they are? And yes, of course I know who they are. You know, we've been on a journey together, a significant journey before we even get pregnant. So even if you start off as strangers and you meet through an organisation or an agency or through Facebook groups, you will spend a little bit of time getting to know each other because you're going to be connected to this person for the rest of your lives, probably. So intended parents and surrogates spend a lot of time getting to know each other, meeting each other's families, and well, we sort of kind of say it's a bit like dating. You're seeing each other to see whether you can maintain a long-term relationship and go through this journey together. So by the time you actually get pregnant, you've probably been through a period of time of getting to know each other, then an even longer period of time trying to conceive. So by the time you're pregnant, you know your intended parents extremely well. And you're more likely to be really, really good friends with them. You know, that's the sort of goal. So, yes, of course, we know them. We know their families. We know their children, if they've got any. We've usually met the mum, the dad, the uncle, the best friend. So, yeah, you know them pretty well.
This is the big part of surrogacy, isn't it? It's not just creating parents. It's creating grandparents and aunts and uncles as well, isn't it?
Definitely. And you are genuinely part of their lives as well. You're not a little hidden secret, you know, that's just sort of, you just sort of give birth and then disappear. That's not how surrogacy works in the UK. It's much more, it's much nicer than that, really.
This next question is a big one. Even I've heard this one several times. How often has the surrogate changed her mind and kept the baby?
Okay, well, it's unbelievably rare. In the last 20 years, the surrogacy community is very small. We all kind of know each other, and stories where something goes wrong are sort of shared quite widely through the community. So in the last 20 years, I probably know of maybe 4 cases where there has been a disagreement after the baby's been born. And all of them has always been because there's been a relationship breakdown between the intended parents and the surrogate through the pregnancy. So it's not about the surrogate wanting the baby, it's more about a breakdown of the relationship between the intended parents and the surrogate. So as a percentage, it's a tiny, tiny percent. It's like less than 1% of cases that happens with. But it also doesn't mean that the surrogate gets to keep the baby. That's also a myth. So what happens is it goes to court, and like any disagreement with children, it goes to family court, and the judges decide, and the courts decide who the child should live with and be raised by, because it doesn't matter what the intended parents feel about it, it doesn't matter what the surrogate feels about it. The courts always act in the best interests of the child. So it's whatever's the best decision for the child. That's what happens.
That is quite a common plot line in dramatisations, as we've seen it as an organisation, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that usually surrogacy is very, very boring, would be very, very boring on the set of Hollyoaks or EastEnders if everything kind of went to plan and everyone was really happy, which happens 99.99% of the time with normal surrogacy.
But what if the hormones make you fall in love with the baby once you see it?
Yeah, that's kind of a myth as well. I mean, we're still working on the basis that women feel this immense rush of love as soon as they see their own child. And we sort of know over the last few years that actually doesn't happen in a lot of cases. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it takes a few months for you to bond with your own child. You know, and with surrogacy, your bond is with the intended parents. They're your best friends. And so you're babysitting that child for a short period of time. And you look at that baby and you just see your best friend's baby. You don't see a child that you've carried yourself. And similarly, people say, well, the baby must want you because you've given birth to it. Well, actually, I've sat there and my intended mother has been breastfeeding next to me. And when the baby cries, her breasts start to leak milk and the baby happily takes milk from its mum. And it would be really great if there were some studies on hormone levels of surrogates after birth. I think that would be a really good study to do, because people are working on the basis that when an adopted child is born, that there is loss. You know, there's this feeling of loss, which we know with, you know, being in the surrogacy community, that that's not what it feels like when you give birth to a surrogate baby. You just feel immense pride and happiness when a surrogate baby's born. So it would be really nice to have some scientific study on surrogates' hormones, because no, we don't look at that baby and feel that we must keep it and it's ours. No, that just doesn't happen.
I think there is a lot of confusion between the difference in surrogacy versus adoption, isn't there? You know, a lot of the terminology that we hear within the organization are very, sometimes they're just outdated, but sometimes they are more adoption specific terms rather than surrogacy specific terms. But a few of the questions that we've got coming up will reflect that. Next one is, what if the surrogate falls in love with the intended father and runs off with him and the baby?
This is a normal Hollywood scenario for surrogacy, which is really bizarre. It's complete drama, doesn't happen, and the surrogate doesn't want to live happily ever after with the intended father and raise a child with him. That just doesn't happen.
Next question. How long are you going to keep the baby before you'll hand it over to the parents?
Yeah, there is this idea, because this period of 6 weeks has been spoken about quite a lot. You know, it's 6 weeks before you can sign the paperwork for the parental order after the baby's born. That doesn't mean you keep the baby for 6 weeks. The baby is literally born into the arms of its parents. The parents are there at the birth. The parents get skin-to-skin contact, they do all the feeding, and they are the primary caregivers from the first moment that that baby is born. The surrogate has no caregiving duties whatsoever. She's just interested in having tea and toast at that point.
So the six-week period that you referred to, as you say, the parents are the primary caregivers. Am I right in thinking that there are some permissions that the surrogate need to give in terms of like the medical care that the surrogate baby needs to receive within those 6 weeks or within the lead up period to when the parental order is signed?
She can do. It depends on what's required. So the intended parents, before baby's born, will have registered with a GP, with a midwife. They'll be on the list for the health visitor. So they have their own sort of medical care for that baby after it's born. And medical professionals, on the whole, tend to take a very common sense approach in the fact that the parents are, you know, the parents in all sense of the word. Occasionally, we do get midwives, hospitals, etc., that still consider the surrogate to be the legal mum, so she has to make all the decisions. So sometimes surrogates sign a letter to say that the intended parents can make all medical decisions, and that usually suffices. We've had a few occasions where a hospital has needed to call the surrogate repeatedly to get permission for medical treatment for the baby. The surrogate has repeatedly referred them back to the intended parents, but it really does depend on the medical professionals. But it has helped considerably having the new government guidelines for healthcare professionals, which does state that a common sense approach should be applied to who's making decisions for that baby, and it should be the intended parents.
So it sounds like that some of the more outdated policies surrounding surrogacy decisions within healthcare professionals they're kind of coming around, and they're becoming a bit more modern in their thinking, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's not actually the healthcare professional's fault. Usually, it's just a lack of information. Once a surrogate and intended parents go to a hospital to check in for their prenatal care, you know, the hospital may never have experienced surrogacy before, and have got to play a lot of catch up. So the more information that intended parents and surrogates can pass on to the healthcare professionals, the better, because it doesn't come from a place of discrimination. Usually it just comes from a place of misinformation.
Moving on to our next question then. This sounds a bit rhetorical, this question. I bet surrogacy is a nice little earner, isn't it?
Well, I've had that said to me a few times. Oh, you know, it's a good way to make some pocket money. Well, it beats working for a living and all that stuff. No, it's not a job. Surrogates have a job, usually. You know, they work. They've usually got pretty good jobs, or sometimes they're taking some time out to raise their own children. But surrogates don't make anything from it at all. So you're allowed to claim reasonable expenses for surrogacy. So that means that any expense that you wouldn't have had to have paid for had you not been pregnant with a surrogate baby, that's what you can claim. So you can't claim for a new car or a deposit on a house or anything like that, because that's not an expense related to carrying a surrogate baby.
Do you think there's this misconception, or kind of a preconception, if you like, that surrogates, or the majority of surrogates, are poor people and uneducated, I think is another sort of opinion that we've heard a lot, whereas all intended parents are assumed to be rich people?
Yeah, that's true. We do get some sections of social media community who think that us poor surrogates need to be protected at all costs, and we don't know our own minds and we don't know what's good for us, when really the opposite is true. Surrogates on the whole are extremely strong-willed, strong-minded feminists. We want to have a say what we do with our own bodies. We don't need protecting from surrogacy saviours as such. We all know our own minds. And the fact that people think that we're poor, live on council estates, claim benefits, all of that is a myth. The majority of us have good jobs, careers. We just want to do surrogacy for a variety of different reasons, none of which are financial. You know, we can't physically make anything from it. And the fact that people think that all intended parents are rich, well, that's not been our experience at all. Do they have a little more? Yes, because they don't have children. And that's because we know that children are a complete drain on our wallets. So they may have a little bit more, as a single person or a couple who doesn't have children may have. But they're not rich by any stretch of the imagination. You know, intended parents remortgage their houses, they get loans, they do GoFundMe accounts, they get family to help out with costs. They're just normal people who are wanting to have a child, and it matters so much to them that they're going to chuck everything that they can at it.
If they've done their research into the expenses, the costs that are involved with IVF clinics and such, then, yeah, as you say, they would do what anyone else would do, any normal couple would do, if you like, and they would get the funds from somewhere to cover the costs, wouldn't they?
I always think it's weird how nobody judges IVF clinics or anything like that. You know, everyone says, well, yeah, you know, they're doing something, they're providing a service. So yeah, of course that's going to cost £12,000 a cycle, but if a surrogate asks for a few grand in expenses, that's apparently we're making money off it, which obviously isn't the case. And the thing that I always say to people is, well, how much would it take for you to give birth again? And everyone goes, oh god, there'd be no amount of money that would make me give birth. Well, that's the same for us. People think that we're all earth mothers, but we're not, and giving birth hurts quite a lot. So you would only do that because you care about somebody. You wouldn't do that for money.
So it was more of a statement than a question that we had on this list we've collated here. But it is that the assumption that intended parents, quote unquote, use a surrogate rather than it being a partnership, and that the surrogate has dreams and ambitions to create a family.
It's our dream too. We go into it because that's something that we want to do. It's something that we want to achieve. So we're all working together as a team for a goal for us all.
Yeah. I know from my own experience as a surrogate partner, my wife is a surrogate, and you get people a lot that, which is absolutely a fair statement because we're all different, but you get people that say a lot, oh, I couldn't do that. To which my simple response is, well, I couldn't work in a charity shop. I don't think I could donate an organ, but other people can. And so they do.
The one that I always say is, you know, people would climb Mount Everest for charity. They would run the London Marathon for charity. I couldn't think of anything worse. There's no possible way, as much as I love a charity, that I would be able to train and run for the London Marathon. So I can do surrogacy. I can do being pregnant and giving birth. That's great for me. Please don't ask me to run a marathon, is all I'm saying.
So a bit behind the process, because you mentioned earlier about the getting to know period that we have within Surrogacy UK. And one of the statements we've got here is the assumption that intended parents choose their surrogate out of a catalogue or brochure.
Yeah, being sort of behind the emails at Surrogacy UK, we do get a lot of inquiries of, you know, people that want us to send the latest surrogate brochure out to them. Like, that's not how it works. That's not how it works at all. There is sort of this misconception that intended parents are the ones in control. So they're sort of forcing the surrogate to do it. They're sort of pressuring the surrogate to do it. When actually in the UK, the power balance is more tipped towards the surrogate. So the surrogate gets to choose who she helps. If you like, intended parents' profiles are available for surrogates to look through and read through. So that sort of power balance is all on the surrogate. So she gets to choose who she would like to help. I mean, one, you're not allowed to advertise for surrogates as an organisation. So surrogates have to come to an organisation voluntarily. They have to have researched and approached the organisation. That's number one. And number two is that surrogates get to choose who they want to help. So intended parents can say no if they don't feel that that's the right surrogate for them. But the initial contact comes from surrogate to intended parent. You know, intended parents have profiles that surrogates have a look through.
The next questions, you may have again had these from experience. So a big one, I think this one is, won't being pregnant for somebody else be really hard on your mental health?
I think if you put the right foundations in place, it isn't. I think if you rush into things and don't explore the implications of surrogacy and carrying a surrogate baby, you don't have the right friendship foundation with the intended parents, then yes, I can see how it can hurt your mental health. So a lot of time should be taken before you even meet intended parents, speaking to other surrogates, speaking to counsellors, BECA counsellors especially, so they're fertility counsellors who do a lot of training on surrogacy. Those avenues should be explored for a significant period of time before you decide that you want to be a surrogate. So you need to be very sure of your own mind. You need to know before you even start trying to conceive, that you will be able to cope with all the sort of the roller coaster of a surrogacy journey, because it isn't easy. Surrogacy is not easy. Trying to conceive is not easy. So good mental health is a key to being a surrogate. At Surrogacy UK, we obviously have a lot of sessions for surrogates only with our health and wellbeing coach, and that's sort of ongoing throughout the process. We also have a post-birth counsellor at Surrogacy UK who we can tap into as well. So we look at a surrogate's mental health right from before they even apply, through to after having baby and beyond. So it's definitely been a focus for Surrogacy UK, health and wellbeing for both intended parents and surrogates, because it's not an easy journey for intended parents either.
But then again, what pregnancy, regardless of whether it's a surrogate pregnancy or not, what pregnancy is easy? There's kind of the assumption that a regular pregnancy in the traditional sense would be an easy ride. That's not the case either, is it?
No, I think with people sort of say, well, I've had postnatal depression before. Is this going to be an issue? And the surrogates that we've had that have experienced postnatal depression haven't experienced postnatal depression with a surrogate baby, because the emotions and feelings are very different. Also, you don't have to look after the baby at the end of it as well. So it, in some respects, surrogates have a tendency to probably rush back into things far too quickly because they forget that they've just had a baby, because you're not looking after a baby. So we promote really taking care of yourself after you've given birth, because you can just rush back into work and your own family and not take care of yourself physically or emotionally at that point. So we do a lot of work post-birth with our surrogates.
So our next question, aren't you a bit old to be a surrogate?
Me? Yes. So there is a misconception that after 35, you know, you're on the dump, you can't do anything. When actually we found that we've had surrogates over the age of 50. So it all depends on that individual person, their own health, their own obstetric health, which can change, which can be dramatically different from person to person, regardless of age. And what we tend to do is we leave it up to the medical professionals to decide whether a surrogate's too old. We don't decide that, you know, 45 is a cutoff age, because we've had a lot of surrogates that have been over 45 that have done really successful, positive surrogacy journeys. It all depends on, you know, their own personal health and history and obstetric history.
And just for clarification, that you mentioned surrogates that the organization have had that are over 50 successfully.
Yes, successfully. All obviously have been through host surrogacy and gone through IVF, so they've been monitored very, very carefully, and obviously the clinics have their own ethics committee, so it's been very, very successful for us. But as I said, we look at the individual, not age.
Why would you want to be a surrogate when you don't have children of your own?
Well, I do have children, so I'm going to paraphrase what I've heard from the other child-free surrogates, that they want to experience pregnancy but have absolutely no wish to be a parent themselves, but just want to experience a part of that life that they wouldn't really be able to experience without then having to look after a baby for the rest of their lives. So that tends to be the reason. And our child-free surrogates are really, really successful and usually go on to be a surrogate again and again. We took a chance on a child-free surrogate a good few years ago, and we debated about it for a long period of time. And that was our lovely Annie that we took on, who then went on to have 5 surrogate babies and become a trustee member for a while, who now is part of our support team, who then supports other child-free surrogates on their journey through surrogacy. So as I said before, we look at an individual who may have their own reasons for wanting to undertake surrogacy and not want to be a mother. Again, it comes from those preconceptions that every woman must want to be a mother at some point, which obviously isn't true.
So for yourself, a surrogate that has children of her own, it comes this next question. Do your children know slash understand what you're doing? Won't they be the baby's brother slash sister?
Okay, so there's two different things here, really. Yes, all of my children know. We promote openness and honesty with all members of a surrogacy team, and that includes the children of a surrogate. So, you know, age appropriately, you talk about what's happening and what you're doing for somebody else. The children will know the intended parents. They'll have built a relationship up with them. And kids have a really good understanding of what sharing is. And if you sort of phrase it as though you're sharing, you know, you're sharing either your fertility or your body to help your friends have a baby, then kids really do understand that pretty easily. If you are a straight surrogate, so if you're donating your own eggs, there are also genetic discussions that you have to have with your children. And again, it's age appropriate, but certainly for my children, they understand IVF and genetics probably much more than any other child their age does. And yes, they are half siblings, they're genetic half siblings. But my children have described it as, well, your brother and sister are who you're raised with. They just, you know, the surrogate babies just share your genetics. And that's how they see it. They have a kind of a cousin relationship with all the surrogate babies. So they know that there's a genetic link, and they are all told that, and they all understand that. But I think that the key thing is now that surrogacy is on the curriculum for sex education. When they get to secondary school, surrogacy is spoken about. So it's not such a taboo anymore for children. They know what it is. Their friends know what it is. So it's a lot easier to talk about.
I guess up until now, we've made quite the definitive split between the differences in surrogacy and adoption. But I think this point could possibly create a parallel in that if you adopted a child and you already had children of your own, as you say, they would be raised as a brother or sister, wouldn't they? Mm. An adopted brother or sister, but a brother or sister nonetheless. So to kind of show the other side of that coin, as you say, just because they share genetics doesn't instantly make them brother or sister by title, does it?
No. No. And what we tend to do is, so I have been a straight surrogate. So some of the surrogate babies do share genetics with my children. And the parents are very relaxed about the physical similarities between my children and their kids. It's something that we talk about openly in front of the children. So like all of my surrogate babies have a gap between their teeth. All of the children that I have given birth to have a gap between their teeth, apart from little Arthur, who had nothing to do with my genetics. So, but we sit and we talk about it openly in front of the children as something to be proud of, that they look like each other. My eldest surrogate baby's just turned 18 and is the spitting image of my eldest daughter, who's 25. So it's really lovely to sort of share those photos and go, oh my God, this is crazy, you know. And they now follow each other on Instagram. I don't even know if that's the right terminology. I'm far too old for that sort of stuff. But they have a relationship that doesn't involve me. So they know each other and connect with each other that has nothing to do with me. So it's not like it's a dirty little secret or something like that. They all know and are very open about it and are very secure with that.
You used the term earlier, extended family, didn't you? So I think that perfectly encapsulates that.
Definitely. And it's weird because it's like, you know, your best friends. When your best friends have a baby, you sort of take those kids on as like nephews and nieces, but they're not your genetic nieces and nephews. And it's sort of similar for surrogacy, I think.
So we're nearly at the end of our list of misconceptions. I've got one that was kind of in the middle of the list, but I think I'm going to finish on it. So we'll cover these other two. I'll explain my motivation for finishing on it in a minute. These next two questions, they seem to, well, one of them is directly relative to a same-sex couple embarking on a surrogacy journey. But this first one does seem to sway in that direction as well, which is, How do you plan on feeding the baby? Babies need more than just formula, you know.
Oh, yeah. I thought we'd sort of be done with bottle feeding shaming, but unfortunately, same-sex couples do tend to get that quite a lot, which is unfortunate. You know, you wouldn't shame a mother for choosing to bottle feed or being unable to breastfeed, but it seems that the same-sex parenting community does have to face that, unfortunately. So sometimes surrogates will express milk for the baby and freeze it, parcel it up and post it off to them so that they can use. That's absolutely fine. Some intended parents use milk banks where other people have donated breast milk. But yeah, bottle feeding is an alternative to breastfeeding, and nobody should be shamed for feeding their baby.
So we're going back to the mechanics of the INSEM process here, which says, do you play Russian roulette with the two guys' sperm and see who becomes the biological link?
No, not really. So for a variety of different reasons, there is a train of thought that actually, when you put two sperm together, that they actually tend to fight each other off. They're too busy blocking each other to be the first sperm to win the race. So it can actually have a negative effect on whether that INSEM is successful if you put two lots of sperm into the same pot and mix it around. Also, it's really important for any child to know their biology. It's their information, so they should know their genetic story. So it's a lot easier to know already when the surrogate's pregnant who is the biological father. So you might need to know for medical reasons that anything hereditary that may be passed through genetics to that baby. But also it's required for the parental order. So one intended parent must be the genetic parent of the baby, and you have to put that on your parental order paperwork. So you'll only end up having to do a DNA test at the end anyway. So it's much easier to know who the biological dad of the baby is. So what we have done in the past is intended fathers have taken turns once a month. So for 1 month, one intended father produces all the samples. For the next month, the other intended father produces all the samples. So if you want sort of a bit of a Russian roulette, who's the dad, then that's a much better way of doing it than, you know, mixing two sperm into a pot and hoping for the best, really.
This last, it's a statement, it's not a question, but the reason I've left it to last is because I think it's quite an emotive statement, which is surrogacy is a drain on the NHS. Be interesting to find out where this one came from.
That is a misconception. One, that intended parents can do IVF through NHS. We found that it's very, very rare that intended parents can even get embryos made on the NHS. You're a little bit luckier if you live in Scotland or Wales, but it's not guaranteed by any stretch of the imagination. And intended parents are only given the same as what other parents through assisted reproduction get in that local NHS trust area. So we all know that NHS trusts across the UK are cutting access and funding to IVF, and that's no different from surrogacy. In fact, intended parents that are going through surrogacy are more discriminated against, so are less likely to get NHS funding for IVF. So that's one misconception. IVF is, on the whole, 99.9% of the time self-funded. And with regards to prenatal care and pregnancy, is that, you know, the surrogate is only taking the funding from the NHS that the intended parents would be taking if they were pregnant themselves. So it's just replacing like for like. So it's no bigger drain on the NHS than anybody else having a baby.
Well, I think we've done a very good job, Sarah, with busting some of these myths. So thank you very much for your time today. And as listeners, we hope you've enjoyed and have maybe had a few misconceptions of your own quashed by this chat. By all means, if you have any other questions or if there's any misconceptions that we haven't covered on today's podcast, you can always visit surrogacyuk.org And we have a contact form there, which you can obviously fill in and send your queries over to. But for now, I'll just say thank you very much to Sarah Jones for being with us today and for answering all these questions and addressing these statements. We really hope you've enjoyed listening, and thank you very much.
Thank you.